Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zachrin, the assistant editor of the New Books Network, and you're listening to New Books in Political Science. Today, I'm speaking with Moises Naim about his book, The Revenge of Power, How Autocrats Are Reinventing Politics for the 21st Century, published by St. Martin's Press. Moises is a distinguished fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Previously, he served as editor-in-chief of foreign policy, as Venezuela's trade minister, and as executive director of the World Bank. Moises, thank you for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Thank you.
It's really great to have you. The first question I'd like to ask, instead of going straight into the book, is you've had so many different experiences in national politics, international finance, and in media. I'm just wondering how these experiences have shaped your studies of authoritarianism and contemporary politics.
They are critical. And again, I wrote a book 10 years ago titled The End of Power, in which I examined the forces that were fragmenting and weakening power around the world. Now, 10 years later, I just published one titled The Revenge of Power, in which I study the forces and trends and conditions that are concentrating power. And my point is that it's not either or, is that both trends coexist. It all started when I was very young. I became a cabinet member of the Venezuelan government when I was 36 years old. And I was a member of a powerful economic cabinet. And I was always surprised of the fact that people believed that I had huge amount of power, but in fact, I didn't. I lacked resources, I lacked people, I lacked political support and all that. I chalked it down as my inexperience. I was young and inexperienced, and I thought that was the reason. But then in talking to colleagues, I discovered that they had the same feeling, the lack of proportion between the responsibilities and the capabilities that they had around. From the Venezuelan government, I went to work for the World Bank. And there I met cabinet members and ministers from around the world. And I made a point of always probing and asking about their power, how they use it, how they acquired, how they lost it. And I discovered the pattern that there was power had become easier to acquire, harder to use, easier to lose. And that it was happening worldwide. And that was the spark for the book, The End of Power. But 10 years later, what has happened is that the trends and conditions that concentrate power, that limit democracy, have become more acute.
So, you know, power is one of these sort of amorphous words that means different things in different contexts. What do you sort of mean by power in this book? What is, you know, this type of political power or, you know,
You are correct that power can mean different things to different people, but there is one commonly accepted definition, and that is power is the ability of an individual or an organization to make others do or stop doing something. And that definition takes you a long way in understanding dynamics and interactions in the world all the time.
So in this book, what you're doing primarily is you're profiling the rise of a new breed of autocrat that you call a 3P autocrat. So what are you referring to here? Which particular individuals? Obviously, there's a handful, so you don't have to name them all. And what are the 3Ps that you are trying to draw the reader's attention to?
Yes, the 3Ps are populism, polarization, and post-truth. And together, they are a bag of tools that are being used by autocrats in this century to acquire power and retain it, and contain and react to the forces that weaken their power, their grip on power. Populism has always existed and is the notion of stressing the big difference between corrupt elites and a noble people that is abused by those elites, and therefore it always creates conditions for the emergence of a leader, the populist leader that divides the country even more, that becomes very active in creating this rift between the corrupt elite, the abusive elite, and the noble people. But he or she get to power by saying that they're going to fight that, but they very quickly they become part of the problem and concentrate power and all that. And one way in which they do that is by using and relying on polarization, fragmenting ideas, groups, communities, and so on, and making it very hard to govern, because each of these polarized entities has been very often, they have enough power to block others, but not enough power to impose their own view. In recent years, this has been amplified by the 3P, the post-truth, that relies in modern methods and technologies and social media to amplify and make polarization and populism even deeper and more important. So those are the 3Ps. And what is interesting is that to see around the world, different people with leaders with very different backgrounds and ideologies resort to them in different ways. And Donald Trump and Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, they cannot be more different. And yet, when you see their behavior and what they do, it's quite similar. Orban in Hungary and Bibi Netanyahu in Israel when he was in government, again, and they all use the 3Ps to acquire power and retain it.
Are these, sort of characters, a lot of them are also, self-proclaimed nationalists. To what extent do you see nationalism as playing a role?
It's very important. It has always existed, but now is even more so, and it becomes part of the polarizing forces. You use nationalism to polarize society also and agitate and create support for the regime.
Something that you also talk about is the fact that, authoritarian, a lot of these autocrats, that they are initially, at first, at least democratically elected. So there is some popularity to it. And you argue that the preeminent trigger able to activate authoritarian predispositions is the perception of threat. Can you elaborate on what constitutes a threat and why this perception would predispose someone to authoritarianism?
Well, we all like to be protected. We all like to be shielded by bad things happening outside our family, our workplace, our city, our nation. And therefore, you end up having protectionist instincts, both on the part of the people that want to be protected by bad things and bad threats that are happening. And the polarization then is part of that. You identify different kinds of threats and divisions of society and use the other as an example of a threat. We are seeing that in the United States now, of course.
Another phenomenon you discuss is anti-politics. What is anti-politics and what role does that play in this rise that you see?
is a rejection of politics as usual, as the politics of insiders, is the hope, you know, is the idea that, you know, throw them away, throw the rascals away, the traditional political parties, politicians, institutions are not serving the people that elect them. And so is there repudiation and rejection of anything that had and anything and anyone that had to do with power before. And so just kicking the table and trying to change everything. And we see that around the world, more and more people want that don't want insiders, want outsiders, new people, new faces, new ideas, new ways, new enemies, new debates. And sadly, however, very often the anti-politics only serves to propel to power people that that are not equipped to really deal with the problems of the nation.
You know, a question I had when reading your book was, you know, as I'm an American, you know, oftentimes Americans will tend to view politics through the lens of America, and seeing Donald Trump as, you know, the kind of the autocrat par excellence. You know, to what extent do you see Donald Trump as similar, like you mentioned before, you know, to some extent very different than someone like Nicolas Maduro, but also very similar in tactics? You know, is Donald Trump just one of many, or did Trump, you know, Trump's election really help propel this sort of global widespread phenomenon?
No, the trend preceded him, but surely he, you know, was a very important propellant of what of these trends. What is very interesting is how every one of these three presidents or leaders have their specificities. Their countries, of course, have very specific conditions and that define it. But beyond that, you look after you recognize the differences, you start looking at the similarities. And it's quite impressive as a result of the book. I have been talking about this around the world, and it's very interesting to detect how people believe that this their country, that there are exceptional, their country suffered from the three P's, and their country can be anywhere in Asia or in South America, in Africa, Europe. People believe that that is happening only to them. By that, I mean the, you know, their ascent and intensity of populism, polarization, and post-truth. They believe that that explosion of these three conditions only happened to them, but it's a global, these are global trends, which doesn't mean that they are not specificities. What is very important is to know that populism, for example, is often thought about as an ideology, as a set of prescriptions of how to combine markets and government and public policies of all kinds. And it's none of that, because we see populists of the right and of the left, of the south of the world and the north, the developed countries, the global south. So around the world, you see very different heads of state in very different circumstances and very different countries, but that the trends, the three P's are all there and clearly so.
You know, contributing to this rise, you also discuss the role of economic inequality and monopoly power. Can you talk about, you know, what this is exactly and how it contributes to authoritarian authoritarian power?
It has a lot to do with the disappointment about how things are going. People have ideas in their minds and expectations and hopes of a better life for them and their families and children and friends. And on the performance on the part of the government, on the part of the economies, to provide jobs, to provide income, to provide a better life, has created deep frustrations. And those frustrations are, of course, exacerbated by the inequality that we have seen rising in recent years everywhere around the world. And so inequality is a major source of frustration and therefore a major factor that's defining where things are going.
And you know, what do you see that, you know, if this is something, if we battle inequality, if we battle monopoly power, then we will see the subsiding of authoritarians? Or are there other, you know, other issues that are more important to face down before addressing these bigger
issues? What we're seeing is two important things. First is the end of peaceful coexistence with inequality. So the tolerance for inequality has dwindled. And now there are reactions that try to stop and contain the intensity of and how acute inequality is, and fighting against monopolies and the giant companies that concentrate immense power is part of the story, and will be with us for a while. And I think that there could be a change of direction, but it's going to take a while, and it's going to imply many different clashes between social groups.
You conclude the book by talking about five battles, and I can just quickly list them. You say the battle against the big lie, against criminalized governments, against autocracies that seek to undermine democracies, against political cartels that stifle competition, and against illiberal narratives. Obviously, you know, you get into it much more in the book, but I was wondering if you could just give our listeners a little bit of an understanding of what these five battles are for you, and why you think that they are so crucial that we fight them.
Yeah, that's a very important question. And it starts by recognizing and being surprised by how little attention we have given to the decline of democracy around the world. In the past decade, democracy has suffered important setbacks. There is an organization called Varieties of Democracy, which is associated with a German university that publishes studies trends about democracy. And they found, you know, what others have found. They're not the only ones. They, for example, write in their most recent report is that the level of democracy enjoyed by the average global citizen in 2021 is down to 1989 levels. The last 30 years of democratic advances are now eradicated. Dictatorships are on the rise and harbor 70% of the world population. That's 5.4 billion people. Liberal democracy that peaked in 2012 with 42 countries and are now down to the lowest levels in over 25 years. 34 nations are home to only 13% of the world population. The democratic decline is present in all continents and in all kinds of countries. So you have to ask yourself, how could this happen throughout a decade and so little discussion was part of it? Well, one of the characteristics of the 3P leaders is that they undermine democracy from within. They arrive to power sometimes by elections, and then immediately they eliminate term limits. They create conditions for them to stay in power. They control with tricks and appointments and all kinds of tactics. They control the media, they control the judiciary, the Supreme Court, the parliament, and so on. So how could this happen without we noticing, without having a far more robust conversation? And as I said, this is because the trend and the conditions in which this happened were very stealthy, were very opaque. So none of the prescription, none of the five things that we need to do will happen unless we first don't diagnose the problem. No problem has ever been solved if it was not first identified. We need to identify the backslide on the attack, the backslide of democracy, and the attacks on the checks and balances that define democracy as an urgent priority, an urgent challenge that needs to be responded by the democracies of the world and the liberals around the world. And only then it will be possible to deal with the five concrete prescriptions that I offer in the book. You first need to have to develop and energize and motivate people to take on the task of recovering democracy and recovering the you know correcting for the backslide that we have witnessed in the last decade.
And, you know, a question I also have on that point is, you know, obviously, for the most part, like governance is completely organized on the, you know, local and national level. And your book is so internationally focused. You know, to what extent do you think this is a challenge that is going to be, you know, for example, are some countries going to, you know, say no to authoritarianism and become more democratic? Others are going to stay authoritarian? Or is this something that you see as needing to happen across a variety of countries for it to be successful?
Yeah, it's happening simultaneously, and it all depends on the nature of the country, the initial conditions, and the pre-existing conditions, and the kind of leadership that it has. But it's true that, for example, we're looking at the illiberal coalitions around the world. These autocrats are becoming very active in coordinating and working with others like them that have similar regimes. And we have seen that, and so it's very important to develop initiatives that strengthen the collaboration and the working together of the liberal democracies of the world.
One final question that I'd like to ask is if there is anything since you published the book that you have maybe changed your mind about, or have felt that maybe, you know, something you said wasn't accurate, or any ways that you feel vindicated by things that you wrote?
Well, it's still in the middle. You know, the book is just out. The book has been very successful internationally. It's one of the bestsellers in a bunch of countries. And the one surprise I have had is, first, is how global this is beyond the recognitions of their citizens. You know, people, exceptionalism, believing that this is just happening to you, is more common than I had anticipated. I supposed that this was happening to people, and they know that they were part of a global trend. Well, not true. They believe that it's just happening to them.
Yeah, that's very surprising. And I think, you know, on some level, it makes perfect sense, you know, because people, even people in their own countries, oftentimes won't even know what's going on in politics on a deep level. But, you know, I think that, you know, it's definitely very important for people to have this more international perspective. And I think that you do a really effective job of bringing together these different narratives that oftentimes are really difficult to see how they fit together. So, Dr. Naeem, thank you so much for being a guest.
Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for the very interesting questions.
It was great. Thank you.